Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thank you very much for your attention. I'm Paul Quirk. I'm a political scientist. I specialize in American politics. I came to UBC 5 years ago, or I'm director of the U.S. Studies Program. I'm not an expert in the subject of this panel particularly, but I will moderate it to the best of my ability. The subject of the panel is managing the economic arena. Now, that's a very broad subject, which has multiple aspects, you know, from trade, energy, and environment to domestic economic policy, and government institutions and processes that are involved in managing the economy. We have some presentations here that will touch on quite a few of those aspects. The panelists are described in some detail in your booklet, so I'm going to just mention some of the highlights of their qualifications to speak to you, which are very considerable. Brad DeLong is a distinguished economist at the University of California at Berkeley. He is, and just summarizing, the main point is that he has had very high-level experience in advising and policymaking in U.S. national government, especially on issues of health care and trade policy during the Carter administration. Rod Dobell has been an economic theorist. He's been a special advisor to the Canadian government on long-run economic planning. He's now holds a chair in public policy at the University of Victoria. David Emerson has a doctorate in economics. He's been minister of most things in Canadian government. There's a minister of industry, a minister of trade, a minister of foreign affairs, and he's currently the chair of the economic advisory committee to the premier of the province of British Columbia. Chrystia Freeland is a journalist who has had as wide a range of experience in North America as you could imagine. She's been at the Washington Post. She's been a deputy editor at the Globe and Mail, and she has been the managing editor of the Financial Times with responsibility especially for its reporting on the United States. So we have as interesting a group as you could ask for on this subject. The procedure will be that the two people who are designated as presenters, that's Brad and Rod, will each make about 10-minute presentations. They'll be using PowerPoint, so we'll clear out of the way so you can see the PowerPoint a little bit more clearly. Then Chrystia and David will make brief comments, which will be of two sorts. One is actual reactions to the presenters' papers, but I've also asked them to just give us their pitch as to the most important things for this audience to hear on this broad subject, whether it comes from reacting to these presentations or from their own heads. I want to make a couple of technical announcements. One is that some of the papers for this panel, the two papers, are now posted on the web. They got there fairly recently, so you might have looked for them and not found them, or at least they will be by the time you get a chance to check for them. The other is the routine for the audience participation includes a microphone, and you should understand that this microphone is not just for this room. It's mostly for the webcast, so do try to make sure that you're using the microphone and waiting for it and holding it where it can be functional and so forth when we begin.
4,000 years from now, your words will be archived.
That's right.
And globally accessible.
So we'll start with
thank you.
Brad DeLong. And we're going to move out of the way. So.
Well, no, I don't have any PowerPoints.
So I was sitting in the back blanking early this morning, wondering what to say up here. And it struck me that what I should do is move number 8 in conference-ship, which is, if you don't know what to say, always start by attacking the title of the session that you are in. And so I want to pick a bone, or pick with the title, Managing the Economic Arena. If we could manage the economic arena, 13 million more than normal number of people would not be unemployed or underemployed in the United States right now. 2 million more people than normal would not be unemployed or underemployed in Canada. U.S. production would not be $1 trillion a year less than what 2 years ago we thought it was going to be. And Canada, a very good actor as far as financial regulation and the avoidance of irrational exuberance is concerned, would not now be suffering from a depression almost as deep as that of the United States. We don't manage the economic arena. We try to order what we can, yet it doesn't fit with what we're eventually served and what we have to eat. And there is a second dimension along which managing the economic arena is, I think, a misleading kind of title for a session. It assumes that governments, especially the U.S. government, is a rational or at least a semi-rational actor, able to formulate public policies that advance the ideal and material interests of the median voter sitting between the Rio Grande on the one hand and the true North strong and free on the other. And that is false, right? U.S. governance is broken. And that U.S. governance is broken has been perhaps the most consistent thread underlying this conference so far, but it's always been kind of in the background and alluded to. So let me very briefly just remind you of the two significant things the Obama administration has tried to do to date. The first is that it's tried to manage the gathering depression. And if you go back to October 2008, and if you look at the views of how to deal with the coming depression that were then held by senior advisors to the Obama campaign, say Larry Summers and Berkeley's own Christy Romer, or by senior advisors to the McCain campaign, people like Mark Zandi of Moody's and Douglas Holtz-Eakin, who has a brand new gig as director of some brand new Republican think tank that is supposed to be more credible than Heritage while not being so staid and invisible as AEI. As a partisan, I would hope that we'd be as credible as Heritage and as visible as AEI. But as an American, I have to hope otherwise. That their views and the views of the technocrats in office like Hank Paulson and Tim Geithner and Ben Bernanke were all very similar. And no matter whether Obama or McCain were to have won the presidency, the odds were very heavy that policies over the past year would have been very similar and very similar to those we have seen. Large banking recapitalizations, large federal support for asset prices, with the side effect of enriching many of the bad actor bankers. Extraordinary expansionary monetary interventions by the Federal Reserve, substantial additional deficit spending program divided between government purchases and tax cuts. There would have been differences at the margin, right? More tax cuts for McCain, more spending increases for Obama, a greater possibility of actual bank nationalizations under Obama than McCain. But how many of you looking at Washington today would say that there was substantial bipartisan agreement on the contours of anti-depression policy? Nevertheless, that's the reality. As a little thought about the fact that had John McCain been elected, Ben Bernanke would almost surely have also been renominated to be chairman of the Fed, and that Tim Geithner would have been a highly credible candidate for John McCain's Treasury Secretary. That partisan claims of large differences in anti-recession policy between the likely policies of administrations of different party are simply kabuki theater. Yet the kabuki theater of partisan Washington has the side effect of having made the U.S. government's ability to act in this crisis quite small. That is, you talk to the Obama people and they say, well, we did everything the 60th senator would allow us to do. And question of why, well, there are the 40 senators who would vote against everything just because we didn't work of their party. Second, the Obama administration has tried to deal, health care, right? Relative to a normal country like Canada, the United States' health care system right now wastes $1 trillion a year, both on the private and the public side. and that we spend much more money than any other North Atlantic economy, and yet have a healthcare system that does rather less to cure disease and ensure long and healthy lives, right, on average. And about $400 billion a year of this comes from higher doctors' salaries in the U.S. relative to median wages in a country. About $300 billion comes from unnecessary, inappropriate, ineffective, and positively harmful care prescribed by doctors who fear malpractice liability and simply do not know what treatment protocols are worth doing. Go to the Mayo Clinic, and the cost of your treatment will be on average half of what it is at the Reagan Center in UCLA. And Mayo Clinic's actual outcome measures for practically every disease are a little bit better. We in California would like to trade the Mayo Clinic for Reagan's Medical Center. People in Minnesota have a very different view. And $300 billion a year is spent in administration costs as insurance companies play the game of trying to pass the costs of paying for treatment of the sick off to somebody else or rationing people by hassle in an attempt to get them to stop trying to claim benefits to which they were entitled. Just 3 days ago, I was admonished by my wife for having failed to get a large enough receipt from our pediatrician, which has greatly upped the chances that taking my daughter to the doctor because she is nauseous and not going to school will be denied by our flexible spending account, because the fact that we didn't submit a big receipt indicates that it would probably be a hassle for us to document that this is a legitimate expenditure, and so they're going to try to grab the $20 copay away from us, or at least make us waste more than $20 of our time to get it back. Now, when he was governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, Republican politician, constructed and passed with bipartisan support a health care plan. And now Barack Obama has thrown his weight behind a Senate health care bill that is in its essentials, Mitt Romney's health care plan, so much so in its essentials that the Wall Street Journal editorial page is saying it would be prudent to delay the Obama plan for 2 or 3 more years to see how it works out in Massachusetts before undertaking such a big experiment. Yet this plan may well not pass, and it may well not pass because it will not get a single Republican vote in the Senate, even though the only reason the new Republican senator from Massachusetts, Scott Brown, can think of for voting against it is that it doesn't do anything for the voters of Massachusetts that Mitt Romney has not already gotten for them. And so when the United States will not even formulate policies that advance the ideal or material interests of its own citizens, what chance is there for diplomats and politicians in Canada to get the U.S. political system to rationally consider and weigh their interests as well? That's zero. The interests of Canadians, well, they're generally not of first-order importance in the minds of U.S. citizens, and the interests of U.S. citizens are not even of first-order importance in shaping the decisions and policies enacted by Washington. So joint rational management of any part of our common North American home is simply not on the menu, or not on the menu unless we do something radical to change U.S. governance. Given that, what is Canada to do? Right? Canada does have major economic interests in the good behavior of the United States. It really wants to see 4 things. It wants to see a healthy and growing U.S. economy. It wants to see a U.S. that performs the role of benevolent conductor of the world trading system. It wants a U.S. economy that in any event remains open to imports from Canada and lets Canada participate in the economics of scale of continent-wide economic integration. And as Ambassador Gottlieb said this morning, Canada seeks a U.S. that joins rather than sits on the sidelines in the efforts to manage our energy and global warming future, a thing of extraordinary interest to Canada, both because it has potentially huge energy reserves, and in a world in which global warming seems to have one in which the Arctic region heats up the fastest and first, is subject to greater risks and possibly greater positive offsets, depending on what you think of real estate values in central Alberta. So these are the 4 things Canada needs. As for 1 and 2, the U.S., a healthy U.S. economy and the U.S. as benevolent conductor of the international orchestra, well, we want them too, and we can't think of any ways to make U.S. policy better, so we advise the Canadian diplomats to focus on other things. That will work better. Number three is actually quite frustrating. Yeah. That is because number three, they thought they had done it back in the 90s. That number three is essentially attempting the U.S. to induce the U.S. to live up to its NAFTA treating obligations. Ambassador Pickering earlier today said he was a wild-eyed optimist, and as evidence for his claim that optimism was warranted, he said that on very sticky and difficult issues we had made by working very hard, real progress on things like softwood lumber and Buy America. As best as I can see, the progress has been made is that now the United States admits that its policies on softwood lumber and Buy America are in striking violation of its NAFTA treaty obligations, rather than pretending that they are not and ignoring that. And that the United States government now admits it should feel slightly guilty about its failure to honor its NAFTA treaty obligations, rather than continue to brazenly violate them without a thought. In my view, Ambassador Pickering was claiming the glass was half full when it is not clear to me that there is any glass there at all. And I was going to talk about global warming and energy, but if I do so, it will make the moderator sad. So let me wrap up in one more minute by putting forward the only thing I've been able to think of to actually cut this Gordian knot. On the grounds that whatever else you think of Alexander the Great, he at least cut the Gordian knot. Earlier today, Ambassador Gottlieb lamented the reestablishment of the border and called for a world in which there was no U.S.-Canada border. Let's take him at his word. Conquest. Conquest eliminates the border. Conquest means that when I'm lucky enough to get invited to the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City's summer jamboree, it's held not in the second-rate mountain resort that is Jackson Hole, but the first-rate mountain resort that is Lake Louise. And in the U.S., it would change the median voter from being the guy with a Ford pickup truck listening to country music outside of Nashville to a nurse practitioner in Ottawa. And I think all three of these changes would probably be to the benefit of North America and the world as a whole. Conversely, if conquest is felt unseemly, there is another precedent to consider. That after all, in 1660, England or Britain, Britain plus Ireland, was a commonwealth, a republic. And in 1660, the governing body of that republic reconstituted itself as a parliament and sent congratulations to King Charles II on the 12th year of his reign. The U.S. Congress could rename itself the Parliament of the Dominion of Baja Canada and seek regularization through the appointment of a proper Governor General by Elizabeth II Windsor. And we could even do it with 50 votes in the Senate through reconciliation if Doug Elmendorf would say it had substantial budgetary implications.
Your concern about making me sad is a lot like the American concern about violating the NAFTA treaty, I think. Yes. Thanks.
Well, it's a very great pleasure and privilege for me to be here. I can't pretend to have the credentials to be here in this company, but I'm delighted in any case to be amongst you. I'm particularly intrigued at two interesting features here. It's wonderful to be here in the fantastic setting of the Brouwer Center, an icon from my youth, and I'm really happy. I didn't realize when the invitation came that this was the possibility. Second is, it just occurred to me that it was a dropout from Berkeley who changed my life as an economist when he came to me as a student when I was a professor of political economy at the University of Toronto. And that impact from Berkeley has, as I say, stayed with me for forever. So I'm happy to be here. I have far more than can be said in the time allotted. I should say that I start from sort of 50 years ago when I became enchanted with the duality properties of linear programming models, which turned out to be very much like the dynamics of markets with competitive prices. And the existence of the dual variables, which were equivalent to prices, was just a remarkable thing. It drove me to MIT, where I turned to intertemporal optimization, and it turns out there are co-state variables as you try to make decisions optimal over a long horizon, which function exactly like asset prices. They have wonderful properties. The thing that intrigued me is that those models, perfect models with perfectly working markets, perfectly functioning transmission of information, are unstable. They're unstable because speculation in the assets yields price behavior, which drives things ultimately to bubbles and to collapse. The only thing that stabilizes them is perfect foresight, the ability to attach values in the future to the assets that you're building up now. It was a wonderful proposition that intrigued me for lots and lots of papers. But there's a lot of things that got in the way as we went along. I hope I have time to go through this. I want to talk briefly about context, some lessons that were drawn from the crisis, that is to say the Great Recession, a few comments about underlying causes, some implications for Canada-US integration, consequences for the future, and I've got a few questions at the end, which I hope we'll get to. I want to challenge you to think outside the box. The structure of the program for this meeting intrigued me. We start with Canada-US. I wondered about what that was in the North American context, but the panel added the South and the North, and that's the second Canadian border, and it's the one with the circumpolar community, which we have to mention a lot this morning. We have to really, really think about where that community is going and its impact on the rest of us. There was also another contextual thing, culture and environment. We have sessions on both of those. And the point I want to make, I guess, is that that's extremely important, but the environment has to be interpreted very broadly. I want to think about the whole ecosphere. Atmosphere, hydrosphere, biosphere, lithosphere, all these things get into the language a little bit to talk about a surrounding mechanism. The ecological system has within it this is an expression which was introduced, I think, by Vernadsky. Writing in Moscow in 1943, he expressed optimism about the future of humanity, which had become a mighty global geological force, but self-conscious, reflexive, and through its democratic instincts, holding within it the capacity to move on to living within the confines of the ecological limits. A remarkable piece of writing, translated into English in 1947 or 48, I guess. The noosphere is a social system. It has within it, of course, an economic system. My point is we create that economic system. It's a construct not given to us, whose laws aren't necessarily something we have to obey, regardless of our thinking on the issue. Within that, of course, is a financial system, which even more is a construct. Paper assets as claims to real resources. The machinery by which we claim them is up to us to design and to use in the way that we ought to. There are a lot of kinds of capital, natural resources. They shouldn't disappear quite so quickly, actually. But anyway, the point is they matter beyond what's happening in the economic system. And this whole question of the scale of material throughput, whether it is structured around market transactions or less formal community transactions. Okay, we're going to have to move along. Okay, what I learned from the literature here is that we have the wrong metrics. Nordhaus-Toben told us that in 1973. Sen and Stiglitz told Sarkozy that last year. We're using the wrong metrics to measure human well-being. We report on gross domestic product. We should be reporting on something much, much more substantial. That means we're trying to maximize the wrong things. We got the wrong models of efficient markets working for us. There are a lot of these unpriced capital resources. The markets for valuing them are missing. So we need practical social regulation. We got to work within very complex social ecological systems, very different from the well-structured models of conventional economics. We've got to address the whole question of the assumptions by which we characterize the motives of humans in economic models. We had talked actually briefly about this question, whether the behavioral economists are ever going to have any impact on the teaching of economics. Some of you may have seen an interesting paper by Robert Frank exploring the question whether the teaching of economics influences people in the direction of moving away from a cooperative instinct, cooperative impulse, towards a model of quote-unquote man as an individual who maximizes self-interest in individual transactions. Feminist literature tries to teach us that relationships over a longer period matter. Bowles and Guinness talk about generalized reciprocity. Those are long-term civic impulses that are much more important. The last line there said people have trouble making decisions. This is a violation of the transitivity axiom required for consistent behavior. It also means Barry Schwartz used this to illustrate our problems with finding the right thing against which to measure opportunity cost. Okay, more learnings. I take particularly James C. Scott's work on seeing like a state. It really, really matters when you're implementing policy to look at the site, the characteristics, the particularities of place. I'm very impressed here with the form follows fiction school. The importance of the stories we tell ourselves, I argue that we have the wrong story when we tell our stories about efficient functionings of markets. The distributional concerns, this was the thing that my dropout from Berkeley, got me really worried about the inadequate attention in economic models to inequality. Well, we're not going to be able to talk about the second Copernican revolution. It's a wonderful thing. I'll talk to anybody about it later. But basically, it says we have a different view of the way science works. Well, democracy trumps expertise. We do need social oversight and regulation. We have to look really deeply at this principle of subsidiarity, participatory adaptive management, look at risk management models. And these are the sorts of questions. Can we, in fact, use market mechanisms within democratic processes? If we moved to I guess that story has to be told later. I was arguing you try to address global dilemmas by acting.
Why don't you go through your implications in a more orderly way? I'm sorry, I may be pushed too fast.
Okay, well, let me just briefly on this idea. Question was, can you get any purchase on global dilemmas with action at the level of some groupings of national nations, states? And if it is necessary to introduce some kinds of border tax measures to protect those states that are acting as first movers, can you have that without having bad non-tariff barriers? I mean, one is good, one is bad. They look like the same thing on paper. How do we make the distinction? Can we recognize that there are different cultural settings? We heard a lot about that this morning. They do, it seems to me, yield different balances in the roles of government and markets and civil society and communities. And the question is, could you have tighter integration economically while respecting those differences? Can we treat the problem as a problem of social risk, which requires much more interaction, much more participatory democracy, appeal to subsidiarity? Could we go to, for Canada-US issues, things like the IJC or the Pacific Collaborative on the West Coast or the Gulf of Maine Council on the East Coast. And that leads to the two final questions. Could we, with the two countries, or really in a trilateral initiative, be a sufficient first mover? I don't know the answer to that question. Can we hope to move toward the resocialization that would be necessary to reduce material throughput to the point that we live within the constraints of the planet? And could we imagine North America, which would have to be the first mover, North America trilaterally as a first mover in doing that? Because the needs, as Brad finished up saying, the needs are pretty pressing elsewhere in the world. So thank you very much. Sorry for going on too long. This is the hope for re-socialization.
We'll take, we'll have the discussants in the order they're listed. And the first is Christia Freeland.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'm going to respond with a few thoughts and maybe a few reporters' stories to the comments that we've heard, and then maybe try to make some points of my own. And to give you a little bit of insight into my perspective, I live in the United States and live in New York, and I am Canadian. So maybe I can try to combine those two. Both of our speakers have alluded, at least in part, to sort of a bilateral or trilateral or North American approaches to issues. I think actually, and this is something that Brad did such a good job of pointing out, now is not a moment when America is going to be thinking about that. For one thing, as someone who is very emphatically Canadian, living and operating in the U.S. media space, my bad news for all the Canadian diplomats and government officials present here is they don't think about us very much. And when they do think about us, it is often to make jokes at our expense. Canada is having a little bit of a sort of a media moment in healthcare reform. Either for opponents of healthcare reform as an example of how it's really impossible to survive in Canada and you have to travel south of the border to get treatment for anything, which we Canadians know to be false, but opponents of healthcare reform do talk about that. And then our other sort of mini claim to fame at the moment is it turns out we're really good at regulating banks. But apart from that, the Canadian issue doesn't figure too much in American discourse. I think that's always been the case. But Brad's point about broken government is the reason I think that America right now, despite the election of Obama, such an internationally minded person, the American president probably with more international experience in his background than any previous one, et cetera, turns out to be presiding over an America which is more internally focused than this country has been for a long time. I think the reason for that is what Brad alluded to. Americans really are feeling, with some justice, that their system of government is broken. That is the essential point about America right now. And they're right, Americans are right to be worried about this. As part of a piece I recently wrote about Canadian banks, I interviewed Paul Martin, the former Canadian Minister of Finance and Prime Minister, at some length, and I was mostly talking to him about banking reform. But since budget deficits are a coming issue in the United States, and it's something he has a little experience with, I asked him about that. And he said, you know, he told me about, you know, the struggle to pay down the debt and bring in the deficits and so on. And I said, well, you know, maybe that's another good story for me to do, and what are the Canadian lessons for the United States? And he thought about it for a minute, and he said, you know, it's really hard for me to say, because I remember when I got through my first, got my first really good budget I was happy with, I was friends with Bob Rubin, and I called him up, and I said, yeah, you know, we did the budget, it's the plan's all done, and Bob said to me, so how long is it going to take you to get it passed? And he said, oh, I did that today. We have a majority. They just voted on it. And that really is a huge difference. And the whole notion that reconciliation could be a debate, right? We're talking about a party that controls the White House, the Senate, and the Congress with significant majorities. And yet, it's really considered to be, and in fact is politically, sort of a big deal that they would force through legislation. So I think Americans legitimately are concerned with and having a hard time with their government functioning, and that means bilateral issues are necessarily on the back burner. The other sort of American moment to which Brad alluded that I think is a really important one because it's quite different from how the world looked a year ago is bipartisanship really isn't working. And I think this is connected with the notion of broken government. There are sort of Canadians like talking about two solitudes. Well, there aren't maybe two solitudes in the United States, but there are two conflicting notions that seem to be held dear by the political class. One is that bipartisanship would be a great idea and we should be doing things collectively and looking for common ground. The other one is the two parties, particularly the Republicans, but also the Democrats, are fiercely partisan right now. Again, as partisan as they were in the Bush era. And that, I think, is something that is quite surprising to a lot of people and having a big impact on the resolution of issues of the day. What's particularly astonishing, I think, about this political moment is, again, alluding to Brad's comments, the really, really big issue of the day, you know, the fire which has just been put out, the financial crisis, was an absolutely bipartisan moment. When we talk about the government response to the financial crisis, the baton was passed absolutely, batons can't be passed seamlessly, but the baton was passed without being dropped from the Bush government to the Obama administration. And in fact, many of the same people are responsible for administering it. So you had, in practice, when the building was burning, total bipartisanship. And yet now you have an absolutely factionalized political system. I don't have a profound explanation for that, but I think it is the key feature of American politics right now. It might be worth mentioning a couple of other things. In response to Professor Dobell's presentation, I thought he made a really excellent point about this crisis of faith that's happening in the economics profession and this notion of, you know, to what extent is the way that economics was taught, to what extent is the way that we think about economics to blame for the crisis. Someone whose writings on this issue, I think, are really interesting is Willem Buiter, who was at the LSE, is now the chief economist at Citigroup. So in a way, he's gone over to the dark side. As he admitted in his blog, he said he can't tell the truth anymore because he works for a bank. He actually, I don't know, Brad, if you read his blog about that. It was really funny. He actually said this. One of the points that he made prior to no longer being able to tell the truth was that he thought one of the things that had happened was cognitive capture. And I think this is in keeping with the point that Professor Dobell was making. And what he meant by cognitive capture was that the intellectual core of the problem that led to the financial crisis maybe wasn't so much Simon Johnson's thesis of, you know, 13 bankers and oligarchy, the quiet coup of the financial oligarchy. It wasn't about corruption. But what was going on was you had the political elites buying into a notion of the way the economy works, which was absolutely the same as how Wall Street saw it. And I think that's a really profound point and a really important one. There was this moment in the 80s, especially in the 90s in America, where as it used to be that what was good for General Motors was good for America, there was a sense that what was good for Wall Street was good for America. I think that has changed, and actually Gary Gensler in a piece in the New York Times yesterday, which, full disclosure, I should admit was written by my husband, but it's a Gensler quote. And he made a really important point in which he said, Wall Street's interests and the public's interests are not necessarily identical. That's really important, and that's actually a new thing coming out of regulators in Washington, and particularly important since Gensler is ex-Goldman Sachs. There is an important Canadian lesson here, because I think one of the secrets to the strength of the Canadian banking system is Canadian regulators, Canadian politicians. I was talking to Jeremy about this earlier. He can tell you some funny stories about Jean Chrétien in this respect. They have always had healthy hostility, might not be quite the right word, but have had a much stronger sense that the job of regulators vis-a-vis Bay Street is not to encourage Bay Street's growth, but is to regulate, is to be more the policeman than the gardener. And I think that is a really important difference and a sense in which we might be having a moment of convergence. And since it's time for me to wrap up on that happy bilateral note, I will conclude. Thank you.
David?
Thank you very much, and it's a great honor to be here, and I thank Berkeley and UBC for hosting this this important event. We need to have more of them. We probably need to shift the demographics of the room a bit more to reflect what's actually going on in North America, but that's another discussion. Brad DeLong, tongue planted squarely in cheek, was quite critical of U.S. Public policy in a number of areas, and far be it from a modest, humble Canadian to intervene in his logic there. What goes on in the United States, I guess, is up to the government of the United States. Yeah.
But journalists aren't modest or humble, right?
It's... Yeah. But I think what Brad is really getting at, and others earlier in the day were alluding to the same thing, probably most pointedly said by you, Pierre-Marc, this morning, commenting on some of the pathologies of the U.S. political system. And I guess I would summarize it from all of my years of experience in government and business as being money still talks very, very loudly and effectively in the U.S. political system. And I think that's fundamentally, if not untrue in Canada, certainly much less true in Canada. Money does not talk very loudly in the Canadian political system anymore because of election finance reform and a host of other legislative initiatives which have basically given power back to the people in a bit of a populist sense of the word. Now, I guess what I struggle with when I think about why we're here and what's happening with Canada-United States relations is why we are so unable to come to grips with something which is so fundamentally in the interest of both countries. And when I look at the economic situation and the crisis that we've been through, and this is not... It's not just the current crisis, but it's a problem that's been in the making for probably a decade or more. We're finding ourselves losing ground in terms of our competitive position. China in particular, but other developing economies are becoming hyper-competitive. They're coming at North America with a vengeance. They've taken over Canada's position as the number one exporter into the United States. American workers decry NAFTA as costing them their jobs when, in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. It's pressure from international competitors. And the reason I keep coming back to this is that I see NAFTA and the Canada-U.S. economic relationship or management of the economic space as fundamentally important to the preservation and the enhancement of the competitive position of all of North America, not just Canada, not just the United States, but all of North America. And when you back away, and Rod Dobell was starting to get to this, but he had more slides than he could keep up with, but he was heading in this direction. the model of modern global trade today has changed fundamentally. It used to be we had neoclassical economists who were essentially applied mathematicians showing how the theory of competitive advantage and factor price equalization and all of this would lead to glorious social optima of various kinds. But in today's world, you're talking about global value chains and networks. The impact of globalization has been absolutely transformational. It's been profound. It lies behind the emergence of developing economies like China and India and others. And it basically is a world in which wealth is created globally based on information that resides globally and can be acquired by almost anyone in any corner of the world. And so when you look at how you protect North American jobs and how you give a sense of sustainable wealth and permanence and prosperity to North Americans, it's in creating globally efficient supply chains or value chains rooted here in North America. And we are failing that miserably, and we're failing it at the border, primarily because, if I dare say so, the United States has become an extremely protectionist country, and much of this relates back to the initial proposition, is that money talks politically in Washington, and therefore protectionism bubbles up to a senior priority very, very quickly and very frequently. So we've got to find ways, in my opinion, to get back to reintegrating the North American economy and opening up. This is not so much an issue of tariffs as it is an issue of getting rid of those border-thickening interventions that are destroying our ability to create value chains that are competitive in a global context. And if we don't get at that, and it's about education, it's about mobility of people, it's security checks at the border, it's country of origin labeling, it's ITARs in the world of secure technologies. If we don't get through that, we're in serious trouble. And I mean the U.S. is in serious trouble, because China's going to keep coming, as is India. They're going to get you. And if we don't fix it, we're all going to pay a very, very serious price going forward, because in the knowledge-driven economy that we're going into, China is going to be a leader. And, you know, I just watched the evening news last night, and it reminded me that one of the main items on the news here in California is you're laying a fiber optic cable that is going to essentially enable all of the information in the world to be piped back and forth between Asia and North America. They're coming with hundreds of thousands of mathematicians, engineers, scientists. They're going to take us on, and we are falling down, and we're going to pay a price all through North America. And the other piece, which I think again points to what I think is American irrationality, the geopolitics of natural resources is going to get worse. It's not going to get better. And why you don't collaborate and forge agreements with Canada around natural resources and management of the environment, I do not know, because eventually we will have to collaborate in terms of natural resources, environmental management, and management of our economic space and our security space, or we as a continent are going to fail.
I'm going to make one remark, substantive, that kind of is inspired by a lot of this discussion. So I'm a specialist in American politics, and there's been a lot of discussion here of how the American government is broken. And I would like to make just a couple of comments about that. The first is that the essential. I agree with this analysis. The fundamental causes of it are, in the first place, the increased ideological polarization of the party system, the more severe party differences over ideology than there had been in the past. And an important thing to understand about that is that that is probably more like the equilibrium situation of American politics than an aberration. The aberration has been the long stretch of partisan confusion about ideology. with lots of liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats, whose origins was essentially the Civil War. And that took a long time to disappear, but it has disappeared. The other thing that interacts with the partisan character of contemporary American politics and makes it much worse is the rule for the filibuster in the Senate. That used to work pretty well when a substantial fraction of the Senate was moderate enough that you could easily get 60 or 70 votes for something that was important. Now you can't anymore. I do think it's quite likely that the Senate will find some way to abandon the filibuster rule. There's starting to be some discussion of it. It would probably require the Senate to do something that does violate its own rules, that is, to change its own rules by some means that violates its own rules. But I think that will happen just because the current situation is unsustainable. Now, the schedule had been for us to have about 15 minutes for a conversation among the panelists, and we've gone a little over our time. So why don't I just see if there are a couple of quick remarks, if anybody has something that they'd like to say.
A couple of quick remarks. Okay. First, with respect to Paul, that his argument was essentially that it used to be you could build coalitions in the United States, legislative coalitions from the center out, because there were lots of Northerners who were liberal but who voted Republican because Lincoln had freed the slaves, and lots of Southerners who were conservative but who voted Democratic because Lincoln had freed the slaves. And that it's the fact that that historical memory is finally gone that has gotten us into our current situation. Now, I thought I was radical in calling for the conquest of Canada, but he's calling for another civil war, and I think that's going too far. David's remarks about how the softwood lumber money talks extraordinarily loudly, especially given the malapportionment in the U.S. Senate, made me say that I want to give an assignment to Chrystia in her new job as she leaves the best newspaper in the world, the Financial Times, for some high but post I don't understand at Reuters, which is Citizens United. Right. The U.S. Supreme Court has just done a relatively extraordinary thing, has violated precedent in a remarkable way that judges really are not supposed to do, except under enormous moral pressure of one sort or another. That the Supreme Court violated similar precedents in the 1950s and 1960s in the interest of civil rights and other things. The Supreme Court violated precedent to an equal extent in 2000 for Bush v. Gore, which we won't talk about it. And now it's done it again to give the power to make money speak back to corporations. How is this actually going to impact American politics? I don't know. You're shortly going to be able to find out, especially if Reuters gives you its proper share of its resources. I want to talk about global warming, but I've already said my two things, and I'm limited to two.
Okay, good. Chrystia, you had a comment?
I have two things also. Again, responding to David's excellent remarks, I thought the point about protectionism is really important and really well made. And I think U.S. attitudes to immigration are sort of paired with that. While I agree that it's really important, and I think that this is going to be one of the coming issues in the next year, I'm not as persuaded that this is an example of money speaking in American politics. I think that this is also the people speaking. I think that one of the points that Brad opened his presentation by talking about unemployment, and that to me is the single most important economic figure when it comes to thinking about the political economy of the United States. There was a nice try by a Bloomberg reporter, which all the Obama Democrats emailed to me. They were so happy about it, saying that Obama actually has done fantastically on the economy, and it was pegged to the idea that stock markets were up. And all these Obama Wall Street guys were so happy, and they sent this to me, and they said, hey, do you think this is the beginning of a new journalistic trend, that you guys are all going to say Obama is an economic hero? And I said to all of them, actually, no, I don't think so, because as long as unemployment is hovering close to 10%, it's not going to feel great for people. And that, to me, is going to be the really big driver in politics of protectionist sentiment, of borders actually becoming less porous rather than more porous. That might not be intellectually the right response. But one thing that has been missing from our entire conversation is a sense of really how angry Americans are. And Americans are angry. What I think is really interesting about this political moment is they're angry on both the right and on the left. In some ways, I think the feelings driving the Tea Party are quite similar to some of the feelings that you see on the more populist left of the spectrum. People feel that the economy isn't working, and more importantly, alluding to something that Rod was talking about, I think there is kind of a sense of even greater rage because there's a feeling that the 13 bankers are doing fabulously well, while on Main Street it's 10% unemployment. And then just a quick final point on the environment. We've been dancing around it a little bit, and even though we're not all Canadians on this panel, we seem to be pretty rah-rah Canada. I think the environment is going to be increasingly and maybe unexpectedly a point of great tension between Canada and the United States. I am from northern Alberta. My dad is very hopeful that global warming will happen because we live on Misery Mountain, which is very high and very cold, and we live close to the oil sands where my younger brother works. But I think that California environmentalists are a lot less tolerant of that sort of thing. And so we could find that the environment emerges as an issue on which we sweet, nice, lovely Canadians find ourselves being the bad guys.
Yeah, just a few more comments. On protectionism, I guess I'm not arguing that that political contributions drive all protectionism, but I don't think an awful lot of populism is self-germinating either. I think an awful lot of it is cultivated and fertilized by organizations, commercial, non-governmental, who are pushing an environmental agenda to the point of way beyond good science, and commercial interests are pushing their local congresspeople for commercial reasons, and then that gets translated out to their workforce and they become part of the popular. So, you know, I don't think we can disentangle money, but I think protectionism is a huge, huge problem for the U.S., and it's a bigger problem for Canada because there's a big asymmetry in the relationship. We send in 80% of our exports to the United States. That's not what you send to Canada. And so what it will do is force Canada. Sure, we will continue to lobby and to try different strategies to engage the United States and continue to build and stabilize NAFTA. But we've got to pursue some Plan B work, which means we've got to start to worry about how do we engage China, how do we engage Europe, and make sure that we have other trading options. And while that will be good for Canada, I'm not sure it's that good for the United States when we build pipelines to the West Coast and start sending our dirty oil to China. But it's going to happen, and it has to happen for Canada to simply protect its self-interest going forward. I do want to make one other comment, and this again pertains to globalization and wealth distribution, because we don't think very much expressly about the global distribution of wealth and the fact that even though we think China is an economic juggernaut, their standard of living is still one-fifth, one-sixth, one-seventh that of the United States and Canada. And then you look at the other developing countries and you're talking about a tenth, a 20th, a 50th. And if you look at where relationships are breaking down globally, whether it's the WTO or Copenhagen in climate change discussions, not far off center stage is the global distribution of wealth and how countries who haven't achieved the standard of living that we have achieved are going to get up that curve when we're saying, well, the climate isn't going to take it, so you can't. That's going to become a real issue, and it's going to become an issue where Canada and the United States have some material mutual interest in dealing with environmental issues and dealing geopolitically together to try and get through this rough patch. It's going to be a very rough patch.
Do you have a comment?
Okay. Well, then we will open to the audience, right?
One more thing.
No. If you can make it quick, sure.
I remember when we didn't call them oil sands, we called them tar sands.
I said that at a conference in Vancouver 10 days ago, and there was an Alberta government minister there, and she took me aside. And she said, just don't say that anymore. Okay.
I think the global distribution of wealth point cuts two ways. That is, global warming means either a lot more rain and snow or a lot less in the watersheds of Asia. And we really don't know which. We know it'll probably get warmer over the globe as a whole, but we don't know what's going to happen to rainfall patterns and temperatures in any one region. We just know that they will change. And at the moment, we have 2 billion people who are still desperately poor subsistence farmers in the great river valleys of East and South Asia who rely on there being about the same amount of rain and of snow melt and of snow cover in the Himalayas and the surrounding mountains every year. And if there's a lot more rain and a lot more snow and snow melt, people drown by the tens of millions. And if there's a lot less, people's crops fail and they starve by tens of millions because they are still very poor and can't do what people in the rich global north do to deal with global warming by turning up the air conditioner. So I suspect that when India and China say, hey, wait a minute, you all industrialized with a carbon emission heavy path, why don't we get to that within a generation they are going to have turned around 180 degrees and be running very fast in the opposite direction. Because the fact that they are so poor and have so many near subsistence farmers clustered in the great river valleys of Asia means that they are all at tremendous risk, no matter what the detailed climate effects are.
Thank you very much. So we will take questions from the audience, and I will recommend that we get one panelist responding to each question in order to have, unless there's some particular reason for conversation among us, in order to increase the opportunities for questions from the audience.
I just have a brief appreciation for Dr. Emerson, because to hear your ringing call for more attention to the obvious great phenomena that are happening, and for the terribly influential and probably we can agree negative influence of skewing political futures by economic present realities, is very, very, very important. This whole issue of economic discrimination before the law is very important and very neglected, I think. And voting rights that are deeply swayed by economic power takes away the fairness principle. You can say, yeah, great free speech, but what about fairness of one citizen, one vote? And thank you.
That was more in the nature of a statement, I think, which was fine, but I don't think we'll need to reply to that. There's a gentleman up here who had his hand up first, I think.
Okay,
thank you.
Jazz Seacon. I guess this has come up on this panel and the previous one about the dysfunction of the American political system. I'm not sure what metric by which it's dysfunctional, right? Take healthcare reform. Right, I've done some work on healthcare reform for OMB. Healthcare reform is this dwarf, the expenditures in healthcare in the U.S. dwarf Canadian GDP, right? It's about the equivalent of the GDP of the United Kingdom, right? And OMB said, we're gonna do this quickly. We're gonna restructure part of the economy that's greater than the total gross domestic output of Canada. I'm gonna do it quickly, right? And obviously it didn't turn out that way, which someone reasonable would probably said it would. There's sharp preference disagreements. The filibuster is a problem, right? But the Republicans fired the Senate parliamentarian that wouldn't give them the ruling they wanted to do the tax cut through reconciliation, and they fired him because they thought he would have the popular vote among the public, right? This issue came up among the Democratic caucus in the Senate. This was a no-go because they thought because of the divided public opinion, that procedural move would cost them. Right? So it's unclear to me by what metric it's so dysfunctional other than the president proposed something that's highly debated. Right? And this gets related to money, right? This gets related to the previous panel on identity. There are upsides to money in politics, right? South Asians are the wealthiest ethnic group in the United States.
So can you tell me what the question is?
What the question is, what's the metric that American politics is dysfunctional?
Well, here's one, right, that had Mitt Romney won the presidential election of 2008, a health care bill very much like the one currently moving through the Senate and very much like the one he proposed in Massachusetts, would have moved through the Senate by June of 2009 by a vote of 80 to 20, with all the Republicans falling in line along with the moderate Democrats, and with 20 of the Democrats on the left kind of whining about how this isn't enough. This is a giveaway to the pharmaceutical companies. This is a giveaway to the insurance companies. This isn't real reform. That you made a claim about how there are sharp preference disagreements in how the healthcare system should be restructured. That claim to me simply does not map onto reality when I consider that the bill moving through the Senate is, in its essentials, what Romney did for Massachusetts. And I would question why you assert there are sharp preference disagreements when the bill would have been substantially the same under a Romney presidency.
It sounds like the beginning of a long debate, which we will not actually conduct here, but maybe there was someone. Yes, you, please, yes.
Yes, I would like to have some insight as to where Obama is going wrong from Brad and Christina. Is it, in other words, if we think back to Lyndon Johnson, he would say, let's reason together, and then he would squeeze a part of the anatomy to get you to come along. And I'm just curious, what is the disconnect with Obama? Is it that the political system is no longer working, or is it beyond that?
Let Christia take that, and then if there's some amendment, add it.
Well, I'll give you my currently favorite one-liner, which is that before the election, we thought Obama was really a brilliant communicator, but kind of weak on policy. And I think after a year in office, the conclusion has to be the opposite. Pretty strong on policy, wretched communicator. Insofar as, you know, you want to think about what could he have done differently, I think he has been actually really bad at communicating. I think he's been bad at giving a clear public sense of what healthcare reform is for, what the central message is. And I also think it's astonishing that it is a Tea Party anti-government movement, which has been the most successful at capturing public rage with Wall Street. That should be something a Democratic president should be able to channel.
Can we get somebody else? Yes, please. Right here. Thanks.
Thank you. Let me try to take a 75,000 feet view. And so I'm a little away from the important Obama issue here. And it's about China and the United States and Canada in that context. And it's brought up by David's intervention. We went through about 10 years of a unipolar world as the United States asserted itself as the only real power in the world after the collapse of the Soviet Union. We now know instinctively that's not going to be true for that long because of China, which is emerging not only as an economic power, but also has huge capacities. It's going to try to get natural resources, including from Canada. But it has a population which is growing. It has espoused the laws of the market, although it has not espoused democracy. And the challenge is indeed there for North America, because the competitiveness of China is going to be huge, intellectually, in all ways and shapes. If the answer to that threat is for Europe, the United States, and Canada to consider common objectives in that situation, notwithstanding the fact that China might have a crack at Iceland very soon if people are not careful what's going to happen at Iceland and make it an Arctic state. If we think that the solution is For the Western world, OECD countries, in order to build and transform our societies towards an economy which relates more to the reality than just the paper, does the United States have the capacity to lead such an effort? Does it have the internal capacity to indeed make the major changes it would mean, to make what would be an unusual alliance of this continent with European continent?
Anyone in particular like to?
Yeah, I actually think that lying alliance against China is the wrong way to think about it. That it would be much better to look back to the 19th century and attempt to emulate Lord Palmerston and at least one aspect of Cecil Rhodes. That is, back in the 1840s, there was a dispute over whether the city of Vancouver would be in the United States or part of the British Empire, and 50-40 in fight. And what the British Empire did was an unusual thing, right? Usually in the 19th century, when there's a dispute involving the British Empire, the first thing they do is they send in the fleet and they burn your capital. And the second thing they do is they then dictate terms. Starting with the Oregon Territory dispute, Britain adopted a very different long-term strategy of saying, we're your friends, we speak your language, we're going to settle this peacefully, we're your friends, we're very much like you, we're not going to go to war, we're going to help you develop. Similarly, right now, I think the greatest threat to the national security of the United States and Canada of Europe in 2100 will be a Canada where school children are taught in 2100 that the global north tried to keep China poor and tried to put obstacles in the way of its industrialization or development. Then it might not be China, it might be India. That's the superpower, but it's going to be one of them. So I think we need, starting 10 years ago, to emulate Lord Palmerston and say, we're your friends. We have a long-term interest, as well as you do, in making a common global home and making you as rich as possible, right, as fast as possible. And second, we should emulate Cecil Rhodes, in the extent that his Rhodes Scholarship Program produced a huge number of people in the United States who were relatively powerful, for whom England had done a huge favor at a kind of crucial time in their late adolescence, and they kind of liked that. And so one consequence of this was that during the first half of the 20th century, when Great Britain had its various unpleasantness with Germany, the United States was kind of a pair of wired aces in the hole as far as geopolitics was concerned, showing up very late to both of the parties, it's true, but bringing an awful lot of refreshments when we did show up. We're not going to have, I don't know what, a global struggle with space aliens from beyond Jupiter, which we're going to need Chinese help in 2100. But still working now toward a world in which an equal share of those who will be governing and opinion leaders in China in 2050 have spent substantial amounts of time in the global north, learning what the other cultures are like, is, I think, the obverse, the personal obverse to the global peace and openness point of kind of helping China and India also ascend to their normal state in the global economy. So if Chancellor Bergenau, President Faust is listening, free scholarships to everyone in China and India who's 20, who looks like they might be an opinion leader in 30 years, absolutely free ride, better way to spend your endowment in the long run than anything else I can think of.
I'm pretty well... Yeah, just quickly, I'll add my two bits worth. I'm pretty well where Brad is. I think we have to engage with China, but I don't think we should engage with China to the exclusion of other critically important things that have to go simultaneous. The number one thing is to get back to the table and fix North America, and the number two thing, in my view, is for the U.S. particularly, but also with Canada, to get the World Trade Organization talks going again, because it's the WTO trade framework which is the only truly international body of law and controls and mechanisms for bringing peer pressure to bear. And yes, we can improve dispute resolution mechanisms, but that's, to my way of thinking, a very, very important way to contain the behavior of, I don't want to call them rogue administrations, but
The Chinese or the Americans?
Everybody. Every rogue.
Since Professor DeLong is on a roll, I want you to keep going and answer this question. The Congressional Budget Office suggests that by 2019, the United States will have accumulated an additional roughly $10 trillion of debt. If you're sitting outside the United States, as we are, what are the foreign policy and economic and inflationary implications of $10 billion of debt?
What's a few zeros?
Well, look, the economist in me wants to say that such a large volume of debt means a high interest rate on U.S. government securities and a relatively low value of the dollar. The problem is that that's not what markets are expecting. You know, that markets are expecting that the world economy will swallow the extra debt the United States is going to issue over the next decade and will do so without a burp. You know, that global appetite for assets perceived as safe in an unstable world is so large that even the U.S. debt accumulations up to 2020 won't materially exhaust the U.S.'s debt capacity. And, you know, I don't like to accept that, right? I mean, I kind of think that the tipping point for the stability of U.S. fiscal policy ought to come considerably more quickly. But if so, then 30-year Treasury rates and 20-year TIPS rates ought to be much higher than they are now. Right, that at the moment, people are laying enormous bets on the Treasury market under the assumption that the U.S. deficit doesn't become a problem until people like me start retiring in 2025 and start demanding that Medicare not only pay for what it pays for today, but also, say, pays to have a cloned heart grown from my own tissue in reserve in the local hospital in case I just happen to need it swapped in someday.
If I just quickly say, Brad, don't assume, though, that markets are always right, right? If it was 2002, we would be saying markets are assuming U.S. house prices will continue to rise for another 15 years.
Yes.
Yes.
Robert Peth, yeah.
I think Professor DeLong's idea of inviting all of the Chinese for free scholarships at the University of California system is a wonderful one that the state legislature should take into account very soon. Actually, there are more Chinese studying in American universities than from any other country in the world, about 10 times more than from Canada and from Mexico put together, which brings us back to what I thought was going to be the subject of this panel, which is, should we be considering ways to consult and coordinate economic policy among the three countries of North America, given the level of economic integration? If you take just two examples, for example, the auto industry, which suffered a major collapse, many of us had thought that the auto was not a U.S. auto. It was a North American auto made in all three countries. And yet we came up, each of our countries came up with their own approach to the auto crisis. Would it not have been better? Should we not be thinking of ways to manage our economic policy so that we can coordinate approaches to things like that or things like the stimulus package? What kinds of mechanisms of consultation leading eventually to mechanisms of coordination and economic policy should we be thinking about for North America?
Before anybody answers, let me point out that we're getting near the end of our time, and that's a pregnant question that more than one of you might want to address. So let's kind of close on this question of whether there should be some effort to coordinate economic policy greater than we've had, whether it's feasible and realistic. See if anybody would like to address that, and as many of you as would like to, we'll have time for.
Well, I think the answer to that question is absolutely yes. I think we should be collaborating across a range of economic policies, not just at the national level through tariffs and national level barriers to trade, but we should be collaborating in regulatory areas, the auto pact. There actually was a fair amount of collaboration between Canada and the United States on the crisis in the auto sector, but there are so many other areas where we should be collaborating that might not look like economic areas, but they are. The environment is one. Ecosystems do not know borders. We should be collaborating on environmental policies across a broad range, not just climate change and carbon. We should be collaborating on energy-related infrastructure. There is no point having inefficient configurations of transmission lines, pipelines, and the various other elements of energy policy. Security, in my view, we should be pushing it as much as we can out to the perimeter of North America. All of these don't sound like economics, but they are the fundamental eroding factors in terms of what's happening to the North American common market. It's falling apart because we have all these people who have their own story to tell, but the consequence of executing what they want is to undermine the North American marketplace to the great disadvantage of all of us.
Yes, Rod.
Just one quick comment. It seems to me we do need that coordination, but the point I was trying to emphasize is it really does have to be done within mechanisms which enable the direction to be set by a democratic impulse, if you like, rather than a technical analysis based on what I would argue is an outmoded model.
Christy, were you gonna, did you want to address this?
Sure. Yeah, I'll just make a couple of really quick points. I think the good news is on the practical level. I think actually the financial crisis, including the cars part of the crisis, was an example of really effective collaboration, not just between the U.S. and Canada, but actually between, you know, within the G8, even within the G20. And that's kind of surprising given the bleak views here about collaboration. But, you know, when the world was on fire, we did see people coming together really quickly. Having said that, my more pessimistic point is I suspect if we were having this meeting in Washington with mostly Americans present, the notion of North America being one of the main theaters for increased multilateral collaboration, it just wouldn't be high on the agenda. And the point about China is well made, but I think from the American perspective, you're not hearing so much discussion of engaging China with our Canadian friends on one side and our European friends on the other side. It's not so much a G20 conversation as really a G2 conversation. And then just very quickly, in conclusion, what David was mentioning to me is a really true point, which is another place where we are seeing effective collaboration is at the, not at the federal level, but at the provincial and at the state level.
Thank you. Brad?
Since World War II, we built up a large number of, you know, kind of multilateral forums of one sort or another, right? Not only the UN, but the IMF, the IBRD, the GATT, and now the WTO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Then George Shultz decided that wasn't enough, and so now we have the G8 and the G20, and the Eisenhower decided the OECD should change from being a Marshall Plan coordination thing to a permanent thing. So that if you're say, working in Treasury economic policy, well, you don't have to go to the NATO meetings, but there are 7 different meetings of 7 international consultative groups to go to. And I think most of the time, up until 2000, they worked pretty well. You know, that Canada would be kind of unhappy at not being part of a North American forum, but the business that could get done would get done at, you know, G7 meetings and also at NATO meetings and also at the international multilateral organizations. And I think it's largely the rogue Bush administration's attitude toward multilateralism of all forms, whereby very senior diplomatic posts are, say, consolation prizes to be given to people who want to be forced out of Washington because they've lost in internal politics and then ignored. Places you give kind of Paul Wolfowitz and John Bolton when you really don't want them to have the president's ear anymore, rather than serious places to do work.
I very much hope that that's changing, and that the Obama administration and Secretary of State Clinton are properly using all of these instrumentalities of multilateral cooperation that we indeed so painfully and costly developed.
That will conclude our discussion. So let us thank the panelists, who did a very nice job.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.